Hello and welcome to Better Construction with Sean McStay, the podcast where we discuss design and construction techniques, products, and details that lead to a better built environment.
All right, and welcome to this week's episode of Better Construction. This week, I am thrilled to have with me Matt Reisinger. Matt is super well-known, obviously, for his Build Show Network, both the website and on YouTube and pretty much every other social media there is. And Matt, you know, as you guys know, in his spare time, is also a custom home builder with decades of experience down in the Texas area. So, Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sean. I really appreciate you having me, man. Very kind of you to have me on the podcast.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. You know, you and I have traveled a little bit on a few different continents, and
we've we've seen some cool construction on all kinds of different ways and shapes, and all kinds of different projects. And how long has it been since I was in Vancouver visiting you? Has it been six, 7 months ago now? Right?
Yeah, it was, just before Christmas last year, and then kind of a year before that, we were in Switzerland. So
time flies, man.
Good times. Time flies.
For sure.
Well,
what are we talking about today, Sean?
Well, I think, you know, for the maybe five people on the podcast who don't know who you are, maybe quickly introduce yourself a little bit, and then we'll, I really want to talk about, I know a bit about your story of how you got into construction, but I think it's really going to be interesting for a lot of the listeners, because a lot of my listeners are builders, some of them just starting out, maybe looking at starting their own company, and so I want to talk a little bit about that as well, but maybe introduce yourself real quick.
Yeah, so my name is Matt Reisinger. I'm a builder in Austin, Texas. I've been in business 15 years for myself now. And prior to that, I worked for two other builders for 10 years, a national American production builder, one of the top 10 big guys, who hired me right out of college with just a little bit of construction experience, but certainly no great depth of experience. And then I worked for a semi-custom builder in Portland, Oregon, not too different of a climate than Vancouver, where you're based. Pretty marine and quite rainy. And then I moved to Texas 15 years ago, which was precipitated by the birth of my first kiddo and wanting to be near family. And my wife is a Texan. Originally, I grew up East Coast. And so that's when I was able to fulfill my dream of starting a company that I'd always wanted to do. So it's been a fun ride.
Very, very cool. So for you, was construction always kind of an interest when you were growing up, or did you kind of organically go into that direction?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sean. I always have loved woodworking. My dad was kind of a closet woodworker. And always had projects going on. But interestingly enough, my dad was not a very good craftsman. He was a it's good enough kind of guy. So he was more of what I would consider a utilitarian woodworker than a fine woodworker. You know, he would do projects or things, and he'd get to a certain level and he'd either be frustrated or he just felt like it wasn't worth his time to go to the next step of craftsmanship. And that always kind of bugged me. Hopefully Dad's not watching this. I love you, Dad, or listening to this. But around seventh or eighth grade, I fell into starting to watch This Old House. And around that same time period of my life, too, I started doing some construction projects with my church at this really interesting ministry that we did in Pittsburgh, PA, where I grew up. And Pittsburgh had these beautiful old 100-plus-year-old houses in the city that had kind of been abandoned. We had this kind of white flight that happened with all these beautiful houses that kind of sort of got abandoned and turned into not-so-great neighborhoods in Pittsburgh, starting around the 1920s or 30s maybe. I don't know the exact history. So then as I was a teenager growing up in mainly the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of these houses were owned by African-American families that owned the house, owned the property outright, but didn't necessarily have the money to keep them up. And, you know, these were really well-built, solid houses. You know, there was no issues with the double-wide stone construction, but the windows were in terrible shape, or the front porch had rotted steps that were dangerous. So our church did this ministry where we go in and help people actually repair them. And it was awesome for me because I grew up kind of in the white suburbs. I didn't know any poor people. I didn't know any African Americans. And here I got to know people. I got to hear their stories, and I got to help them in a tangible way that me as a, you know, a 12, 13 year old could actually swing a hammer and be worthwhile. And so really early on, I had this satisfaction with construction that kind of stuck with me. And I didn't know about it as a career. I watched This Old House through all those years. I started reading Family Handyman magazine in the 80s as well, and doing kind of projects. But when I got to college, I'd always been interested in cars. And I thought that I was actually going to be, I was going to go into the automotive manufacturing world. I studied the Toyota production system. My degree is industrial management, kind of like an industrial engineering degree, studied statistics. And so here I was graduating from college in 1995, thinking I was going to go work for Toyota. You know, they had new plants that were just starting in America. And believe it or not, Sean, I didn't send my first email until I was a senior in college. And it was on a terminal machine. It wasn't even on Windows 95, which we had on some of our computers. And so, you know, I was sending paper resumes out. And at the same time, a friend of mine said, "Hey, Matt, you should check out this company that's coming to campus to interview. That's a home builder." And I thought, oh, you know, I love building, but I didn't know there was a career in building. Right? I wasn't interested in. I wasn't a good enough carpenter to think I could be a carpenter. And I also knew that I probably wouldn't survive the physical side of that, of being a carpenter. And so I said, no, I'm not interested. And then that same friend brought it up the night before the interviews and said, oh, I got an interview with them tomorrow. They're doing an info session. Why don't you just come and hear what they have to say? And so I went, and for an hour, they brought back these assistant superintendents that were, you know, graduates from my college that had been in the business a year, two, 3 years, talking about what they do for a living, what it's like to build 10 houses at a time with this production builder. And I was blown away. At the end of the info session, I went up to the head guy and was like, "I am so sorry I did not sign up. I am the perfect guy for this job. Please, please fit me in for an interview tomorrow." And sure enough, they did. And I started with those guys and had a great career, and learned a lot of what not to do, working for a national production builder. But frankly, they taught me good time management skills. They taught me, good budgeting skills, how to manage people. They developed me as a manager really well, even though the houses that I was building were not very good homes. And that's probably putting it nicely.
Okay. So that's really interesting. I mean, your background in industrial management and kind of processes and all of that, going from that mindset into building, what made you then decide you wanted to kind of strike out on your own?
Yeah, I've always had a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit, Sean. As a kid, during those junior high and high school years, my dad actually worked in the steel industry and lost his job in the 80s and had a hard time finding other work. He worked for U.S. Steel. And my dad, give him huge credit. He was able to retool himself and went from working in the steel industry to working in high tech and made a lot more money in his final 10 years of working probably than he made in his previous 30. But that image of my dad having a hard time finding a job and knowing that times are really tight around our house for that 2 year period in the 80s, really galvanized in me, like, I really want to not be beholden to a company that could lay me off or that I could be out of work. I want a job and a skill that I own. And, you know, during that time of my life, it was paper routes, actually through papers back when they still did that, collected money from people, mowed a bunch of lawns in the neighborhood, babysat. I did everything because I was interested in my hobbies and funding my hobbies. And that was the way to do it. I was big into RC cars back then. I bought my first mountain bike, which I still have that bike today. So it was my way of being able to provide. And so that kind of stuck with me. And so as a early 20s builder working for this other builder, I thought, man, when I own my own company, I'm going to do things differently. And that really was a big deal for me.
So starting out with running your own company at that point, if you look back at it now and you're thinking about maybe some people who are listening who are in that, What were kind of some of the big takeaways you had in those first 2 years that you maybe wish you could have done differently, or, you know, real big knowledge points that you picked up?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sean. You know, I learned a lot of painful lessons in my first couple years in business. I had worked for a national production builder that was very fiscally conservative. And when I struck out on my own and started my own company, I took the opposite approach. I took a pretty risky approach. I built speculative homes here in Austin, Texas. I started my company in 2005. And the market was excellent back then. Things were booming. And I, you know, of course, everything works out for a reason. God totally took care of me. But I was pretty risky in building some expensive, you know, $1 million plus speculative homes. And, you know, based on the dates that I just told you, you can probably imagine what happened in 2007. I'd built two spec houses. I'd built them to a very high standard. I learned very, very early on a lot of kind of mistakes in the marketing side of my business. And also I learned that, you know, speculative homes are really not a place to do high performance. The market in general, when it comes to homes, is very much price per square foot driven and not performance driven. And so I got caught really badly with a expensive home under construction when the recession really hit hard in 07. Ended up losing, you know, multiple six figures on that project. And, you know, God totally took care of me in that process and in that time. And, you know, much of who I am today and who my company is today was forged through those hard times. So I wouldn't change it in some respects, but if I could give advice to somebody saying, hey, I'm thinking about starting my own company, I certainly would say, you know, try to reduce your risk as much as possible. Also incredibly helpful to have a spouse or a partner who's working either full-time or mostly full-time to help provide for income, live on a very minimal budget, and get used to that for a while, because it's, no matter what business you're in, it's going to take you a couple years to really be able to make enough to provide for a, you know, multiple people or a larger family. And so, you know, what I often tell younger people, you know, the 10-year, 15-year ago Matts that come up to me, who asked me that, I say, look, I would not do speculative houses. It worked out for me in the end. Incredibly painful. You know, I had to pay off like $300,000 in debt. It was really hard for me. You're much better off taking a few extra years and starting on those smaller projects and working your way up to those bigger projects. Because once you do those smaller projects and you do them well, you will go to those bigger projects. And that's hard for a, you know, 20s, 30s something builder to look at that builder who's maybe 20 years in business longer than them and go, gosh, how do I get to that level? I'd love to do those types of projects or those types of homes. Well, all those builders started doing smaller projects typically, and doing them well, making a reputation, and then continuing to do better and better projects. And I think the one thing that I've done that has been right is every project I've tried to do a little bit better than my last project, especially when it comes to the performance aspects of the job. And now that we've got metrics like flow door tests and HERS scores and things like that, it's really easy for us to go, all right, my last house I built was a HERS 65. What would it take to get down to a HERS 60? You know, my last house I built, I had a bloater score of 1.5. What would it take for me to get down below one? What are the incremental things? And frankly, I think that's been a big part of my YouTube success too, is I've really shared a lot of that journey of trying new products and new techniques and saying, what is going to get me to that next better built house that's more durable, that's healthier, that's more efficient, that's going to be a better product for my clients, and also helps me kind of play the mental game of how do I build better? And there's a certain amount of competition, I think, that we enjoy as builders to say, hey, I did things better today than I did yesterday or this year compared to last year.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I am curious. Do you think it's just kind of an internal drive within you to kind of have that focus on better construction, higher performance homes versus, say, like just doing a super luxurious, you know, 10,000 square foot mansion in the hills or something like that. You know, is that something that kind of just was brought on internally for you? Because if you're starting off with spec homes, it's probably easier and more profitable to just build those luxury finishes than it might be to worry as much as you do about performance.
Yeah, I don't know, Sean. I'm not sure how to answer that, to be honest. I've always wanted to do better in whatever I was doing. And, you know, I'm not a particularly great athlete. I never was in my life. So maybe this is my way of having that competitive spirit and that competitive drive of doing things better. And I've tried not to compare myself to other builders as much as compare myself to myself. Yeah. I think back on it, though, I did mention that I kind of studied the Toyota production system in college. One of the things that the Japanese really learned from us as Americans after World War II was this idea of Kaizen. And it's a word we've thrown out a bunch, and it's probably been diluted like the word green building has to not mean much anymore. But the root of Kaizen is we're going to do better, and we're going to always figure out how to do better. And that builds on itself as you snowball. The Germans have it too. If you've ever seen the Miele slogan, the German appliance company, it's Immer Besser, which is ever better. And they're saying they have a similar philosophy. We're always going to try and make each product a little better than the last one. And I think that's really important for us, you know, as American builders. Although I got to say, I was really impressed by the Canadian builders I saw. As American builders, we've kind of rested on our laurels as a community, as a, you know, overall, where we're really most interested in making a wage and a profit margin and paying our people and all those things. We haven't necessarily been interested in doing better and better. We've, as an industry, fought changes to the building code. We've fought a lot of changes that have been asked of us in terms of getting better and better performance. And I would like to change that. And I think that's my YouTube channel is a little bit of my way of encouraging my fellow builders to say, look, we can do better. You know, if the auto industry still built cars like they did 40 years ago, can you imagine how uncomfortable and how different and how inefficient they would be? And yet I see houses all the time built around me in Texas that are built not much differently than a 1970s house, that are, you know, 50-year-old building techniques, and people still saying, oh my gosh, your houses are too tight, you're killing people. I mean, really, haven't we learned anything, you know, in the last 50 years of building that we can't build a tight, efficient, well-insulated house that can last for a couple generations? I mean, a good portion of the world does that as a matter of course. And yet we're still fighting on, you know, gosh, I really wish that this house was $200 a square foot less or whatever it is. And so, you know, if we as an industry educate the public, educate our clients on what they should expect, then we will get a better product out there. And I sound like I'm all doom and gloom, but I would tell you that in the last 10, 15 years, I feel like we've gotten a lot of momentum and people demanding better and builders building better. I mean, you've seen it, I bet, Sean, in your marketplace in Vancouver. I bet the way you generally see builders or even some of the builders you introduced me to, if you compared to what they were doing today to 10 years ago, it's a world of difference. And, you know, that 1970s Buick is not being built anymore. Now they're building, 2021 Lexuses. And even, you know, as a teenager, I really was indoctrinated in how Toyota built such a great vehicle. And honestly, a lot of the American manufacturers were not building a great car in the 70s and 80s. We may nostalgically remember our high school car from the 70s or 80s. That was not a reliable car. It was not efficient. It was certainly not comfortable. And the technology was ridiculous. But the only thing it had going for it was that it was a giant tank. And if you ran into a brick wall, you had a lot of mass. But other than that, it wasn't necessarily safer than a car today. But, you know, Chevrolet, Ford, these companies have really, in the last 30 years, totally retooled how they do things. And now the differences between a Toyota and a Chevy are much less. I still think that some of the Japanese cars are better built, but it's incrementally smaller than this huge gap that we saw 20, 30, 40 years ago between those cars.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I think that's a question that comes up a lot on my episodes is, you know, do we codify this or is this a voluntary standard? And if it is voluntary, is that punishing builders that want to build better? I mean, I you know, using the car example is perfect. I had an 85 GMC Jimny, and you know, if you went downhill left-hand corners, it stalled. So you got really good at throwing it in neutral, starting it back up and going again, and just kind of accepted that that was the thing, like avoid roads with downhill left-hand corners. And, you know, you kind of look at that and go, okay, well, a lot of the rules changed, emission standards changed, crash protection changed, all these things. And now we have cars that, you know, that would never be an acceptable thing for a vehicle.
That's right.
So I do think personally that we have to codify these things, but it is, it's a challenge to balance affordability and the performance for sure.
It is, man. And the affordability thing is such a hard deal too, because we do need a roof over our heads, right? But you know, I think one thing that as Americans, that's a little bit of a struggle is we as Americans have said, everybody needs to own a house and everybody needs to own a certain amount of square footage. And by changing the paradigms a little bit, and I think that is changing, you know, the world of the Uber generation who doesn't, like my nephew, who's 23 or 24, he doesn't own a car. He could care less about owning a car. He has a bike. And he has public transportation in DC and he has Uber. He never wants, at this point in his life, he can never see himself owning a car. He lives in a rental apartment and they travel a ton and they do all kinds of other things that my generation would never think of as a matter of course. But we do need healthy, we need durable, we need efficient. So, and like I saw a lot of Vancouver, there's a lot of multifamily. Passive house has really taken off among multifamily, including rentals. I think that's a really good thing for us as Americans. And the other thing that I'm doing with my personal house under construction is I really tried to limit the amount of square footage that I was building. Now, I am building, in the scheme of things, a pretty big house at 2,800 square feet. But there are six humans and a dog going to live in that space. And I'm at 2,200 square feet now. So it's going to feel like a palace to me, but that's one thing that I, you know, I think about a lot. Gosh, there aren't too many parts of the world that a family lives in 2,800 square feet of brand new construction. You know, I'm in the top 1% of the 1%ers, by living in that big of a house. So by building smaller, we have more dollars, overall to build with and to build to a higher standard than building bigger, dumber boxes.
Yeah, I agree. And the healthiness of the building definitely becomes a pretty crucial thing.
For sure.
If you're looking at high-performance building, and you might put you on the spot a little bit to pick them out of the air, but if you're looking at it, what are kind of the top three things or maybe three common things that you see that builders make as a mistake when they're building their first high-performance building?
Man, I mean, number one, it's always got to be about water management. You know this, Sean. You know, especially as we start building more modern houses with no overhangs, we've got to get our waterproofing details to the just absolute top notch. And the less overhang, the less umbrella you have, the more expensive your raincoat's got to be. And so do everything you can if you want to build a good house to make sure your house is 100% waterproof and you've done all your water management details correctly first. And then get your performance details right. And right after water comes air. And this is especially a big deal for me because I'm in a hot, humid climate. So when air leaks in my buildings, it's bringing with it high humidity, and it's probably going to hit a surface that very easily could be a cold condensing surface. And so I find a ton of mold in my remodels down here in Texas. When that air leaks in under bottom plates, around windows and doors, you know, through electrical outlets, when all these mistakes are made during construction that lets air filter through our building, bad things happen. And your, you know, your company that you work for, Sean, Sega makes all kinds of great products from an air tightness perspective. and a lot of products too, that you don't necessarily have to even change your matter of construction that differently to take advantage of air sealing by using Sega tapes, for instance. That was my first intro to you guys, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. I was trying to figure out how to build a more airtight house, a house that was going to meet a really low blower door standard. And I got sucked into believing that spray foam was the answer. And so I built several spray foam houses and was continually disappointed with my blower door scores. Like, what the heck? I thought these were going to be super tight. I spray foamed my entire envelope. Well, guess what? My blower door scores were not that good. They were incrementally better, but they were certainly not transformationally better. And so one of the very first things I started kind of researching and realizing that was done in Europe all over the place was they would tape their sheathing on the outside with Sega tapes. And so I stumbled into Weglove 100, and I was still trying to figure out in my mind, what's the conversion between centimeters and inches? What size is 100 centimeters? Is that millimeters, meters, centimeters? Poor American builders, we have it hard. When we look at international products, anyways, that was really the starting journey of mine when it came to really figuring out, could I actually build a house that would have a blower door score, close to one ACH 50? Oh my gosh, that seems crazy that I could get that low. And now I'm building a house across the street that I'm hoping to get a blower door score of like 0.5 or somewhere in that range. I mean, what a totally different world than even just a few years ago. Pretty fun.
That's very cool. So another topic that I want to kind of jump into is the YouTube side of things, obviously. You and I have talked about this in the past, and I think, it's fair to say that you didn't ever plan maybe necessarily for YouTube to get as big as it has been for you.
No, that's for sure.
What was the kind of thought process originally? Because I've gone back and watched, a bunch of your first videos, hoping to learn from them. And so what was kind of your goal when you were making those videos?
Sean, I listened to this author, David Meerman Scott. You probably heard me talk about this. He wrote a book called The New Rules of Marketing and PR. It's like, $12 on Amazon. It's been updated multiple times. And I'm actually in the latest update. He interviewed me and added a 1 or 2 page section on my story. But I heard him speak. I kind of followed his principles. He actually has an online course now too you can sign up for. And it wasn't rocket science. It was really using social media as a platform to show people that you're smart. And that was my whole idea on YouTube was just, I need to market my company. I have $0 to spend on marketing. And David Meerman showed this way of marketing without spending money. And the idea is that if you regularly put content out that's helpful, that's educational, that people can use, not just, oh, look at this pretty picture or look how great I am. But for me, it was always, how could I build a better house? And another thing that I kind of reacted to and starting my YouTube channel was I was new to Texas as a climate, having had built in Washington, D.C. and then in Portland, Oregon. I was researching and figuring out and trying to read everything I could about, well, how do you build a good house in Texas? And what's different about Texas and building in hot humid than in cold or in mixed humid or marine climates. And I just didn't feel like the national publications were giving me a lot of good information. I love Fine Home Building. I love Journal of Light Construction. Those are amazing magazines. But I just didn't feel like they had good info for me as a Southerner. And so that's when I said, well, I'm going to take all this research I'm doing and I'm spending a ton of time trying to figure out how to do it right down here. And I'm going to turn it into some videos and those will be my education piece. And so from the very get-go in 2008 on YouTube, I was always trying to educate and take what I'd learned and translate that into a way that could be made in the video. And now here we are a dozen years later and 700 or so videos later, turned into a whole nother thing. And I actually have, you probably know this, Sean, but I have a whole nother business. So I have my home building company. And then I have a company called Build Productions, which now has a website, buildshownetwork.com, which I'm hoping to become kind of the Netflix for builders, where we'll have, at this point, we have one new video every day published there. except for Sunday. And eventually we'd like to have, you know, maybe two or three videos published every single day about how to build a better house, the path to building higher performance. And we're also branching out a little bit too. I think later this year, you'll see that we'll get into a little bit of some design. And Steve Basic, if you know him, an architect out of Boston, is talking more about that. And we might also branch into some of the trades as well, because I think that they're ripe for needing some training. And I also find plumbing and carpentry and HVAC thoroughly fascinating. So ultimately, I'd like to see us branch out to doing videos about the different trades and about building a good house and designing a good house.
Yeah. I mean, I follow obviously Build Show Network pretty well, and I think it's a really unique concept. I had Steve Basic on the show a couple of months ago, and we had a really good chat. And I think that it's something that's needed in our industry. And, you know, like you said, when you were first looking into this stuff and moving into a new area, there wasn't a lot of information out there specific to your area.
Yep.
And, you know, the big publications are great, but, you know, there's a certain amount of pay to play to have products and different things featured in there. And one thing that I really like about your channel is you feature a lot of different products. And it seems generally like you just feature the stuff that you find to be really interesting.
I do. And I do get paid too, Sean.
Well, of course. Yeah. For some of the stuff you do. But that was kind of going to be my next question is, you know, often people will say, oh, well, you know, he's just promoting that because it's something that he's getting paid to say. How do you handle that on your channel when a company approaches you to be a partner with you?
It's a fine line. Over the years, I've mainly only reached out to companies that I've already used their products and liked them and said, hey, I'm already using, you know, Huber Zip or Sega or Polywall LumaFlash or, you know, Rockwool in my jobs. Would you guys help me do this? Because it's gonna support me as an individual. It's going to support this endeavor I've got to educate the industry on how to build better and why you want to build better. And oh, by the way, I'm already using your products. And so most of the companies that you've seen support my videos are companies that I already used and like. I've had occasionally some that have come up to me, and it's funny, the contributors and I have a weekly meeting. And this week we had a really interesting discussion about a product that came after us that I've started a new products roundup video where once a month I'm going to just showcase some new products that I think are interesting. Like, I've never used this. I'm not endorsing it per se. I just think this is really interesting. And so I did that with just a handful of companies that had interesting products. Most of them contacted me and said, oh my gosh, we got a huge influx of new inquiries, our website. And most of them said, hey, I saw you in the Build Show. You know, could we do more with you? And two or three of them, I was like, yeah, that's a great product. I'd love to. Like, random enough, this company called AirX that makes a PVC line set cover. You know how you have your AC line sets coming out of the house and they're covered with insulation, this black insulation. It kind of gets chewed by rats over the years. The sun destroys it. And then a couple years later, you've got bare copper sweaty lines on the outside of your house. This company makes a really nice cover that protects all that, looks good, and keeps your insulation intact basically over the years. I was like, yeah, that's a no-brainer. I would put that on my house. How about you pay me to make some videos and I'll use it on mine and I'll feature it because I like it. No-brainer. On the other hand, another company, and I don't want to say their name, but it's a faux stone, fake stone. It's not made of stone. It's made out of something else. I don't even know what it is. Is it plastic? Is it polymer? I'm not sure what. It's a nail-on product, so you don't even lick and stick it. And so it has some interesting qualities. Like, lick and stick stone, if it's done wrong, can be a huge sponge to create problems for your house if you don't have an air gap behind it. Cultured stone we're talking about. This product kind of eliminates that because there's no mortar to set it into. You nail it on your building. So it's kind of like siding. Now, will it last or will it be durable? I have no idea. Maybe an abject failure of a product. But they came to us and said, hey, we'd like for you to do some stuff on this. And I was like, it's probably not a good fit for me. You know, would any of the guys in our network? And one or two of them, like, Brent Hall, who is on our network, is a preservationist, a real restoration guy. He wanted to throw up at the mention of fake stone, let alone this even more fake version of fake stone. And then we had a really good, right after we got rid of the laughs, we had a really good discussion. Like, would this be a product that should even be in the marketplace? What if it was lasting and durable? You know, I don't know if we'd want to use it necessarily, but would we even let them advertise on our site? You know, would we even let them put a video, you know, a pre-roll ad? Like when YouTube runs my videos, I have zero control of who runs a 15-second ad. You could be, now they don't do anything, you know, X-rated, but it could be whatever. Some terrible vinyl siding or some other product that I hate, let's say, could be an ad before my video, and I have zero ability to even do anything about it or even know what it is, frankly, let alone have any say. But on my network, if we run an ad, I do have say over that and I can say no. And so this was an interesting discussion. Like, I think it's actually a pretty good product for a do-it-yourselfer who's doing interior stone fireplace, because it's basically an inexpensive tile that's going to go on with a nail gun. Perfect application. Would I use it for the front of a two-story house? I'm not sure that I would. No. And is it going to be a total failure and breakdown in the sun in 5 years? Maybe.
Yeah.
So then do we let them advertise on our site? That's been a question that's kind of one that we've had to try to wrestle with a little bit. But over the years, I've loved having that editorial kind of buck stops with me. You know, no, we're not going to do that. You know, the vinyl, hopefully they're not listening, the Vinyl Siding Institute or some trade version wanted me to be their keynote speaker at their annual conference. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. No way. Yeah. No way am I taking your money to do that.
Well, that's really good. And I mean, I think that, you know, with YouTube, the big thing is kind of acknowledging and when something is a paid advertisement, you know, we say it's a paid advertisement, which you do. And then when it's, you know, your opinion, it's your opinion.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of videos about that with different content creators recently. Last question on the YouTube side of things, where do you see it going over the next 5 years? For you.
Ooh, that's a good question, Sean.
You've got your Build Show network that you're working on, and that's going to be growing. But obviously, your YouTube following is growing quite strongly over the last few years. I think you've almost doubled your subscribers in the last 2 years.
I have, yeah.
Where do you think that's going to go?
You know, I've been thinking hard about that, Sean, because I'm in a unique position, and I want to take advantage of that in a way that's positive for our industry and not just positive for my pocketbook. So I've been thinking about maybe doing some back to the basics series. You know, I've always tried to say, what would Matt from 10 years ago need to know in this video? But what would Matt from 20 years ago need to know maybe is where I need to start on a video series. You know, kind of the 101s, 201s. I can tend to get into the 301s and 401s on my videos. And I'm always reminded of that when people are in the comments like, now, you mentioned SH something C. What did that mean exactly? Oh, yeah, I forgot that not everybody knows what solar heat gain coefficient is off the top of their head like I do now after doing this for a few years. I need to, like, stop and explain some things more often. So my video today actually is a little bit of that. I'm talking double glaze versus triple glaze windows and why you might use one versus the other. What's the difference? What do the numbers mean on the window stickers? What's the price difference? Should be a good video. But I really tried to think, okay, now if I didn't know anything about this topic, what do I need to explain? But I also don't want to look like I'm talking down to people, because I do have a lot of really seasoned builders that that watch my show. And I don't want to be, I'm not a DIY channel. I'm not a... you know, a consumer focused video. I'm a builder for builders channel, a pro to pro, so to speak. So I think I'm able to walk that line well, but that's something I've been thinking a lot about. And I think you'll see me doing some more videos in the next year where I'm kind of stepping back and going, all right, let's talk about foundations. Let's talk about framing. Let's talk about mechanicals. Let's talk about air tightness. Let's talk about all these parts and pieces components that go into making a really good house.
Yeah, I think that would be great. I mean, I know I personally would find that interesting. You did a video recently about tension slab foundations, I thought that was really interesting. I've been in the industry for 15 years, but some of the points you brought up about it, like doing a retrofit on a house with a tension slab, I hadn't really thought about that to any significant amount. So I think definitely there's a need for that.
Yeah.
As I get towards the end of these episodes, my listeners know I always ask two questions. And so the first question is, if there was a misconception about better construction that you could just magically eliminate, which misconception would you pick?
Whew, that's a hard one. I should have thought about this ahead of time, Sean. A misconception about high performance construction. I think the air tightness, fresh air misconception is one I would love to snap my fingers on. I feel like we spaced a lot of time going back on this one over and over and over again. And how many other submarine analogies can I bring out? How many other, I'm in my BMW going on the highway at 90 miles an hour analogies can you use on air tightness? It's one that just, I just am resolved to know that I'm just going to have to continue to make videos about is it dumb to have too tight of a house, because that's just such a common misconception among people out there. I think the crowd that you and I run with, Sean, and probably the people listening to this, don't need to be sold on why airtight construction is better. But the general public is still, man, we wrestle with that.
Yeah, I agree.
And right now, my favorite analogy is the Yeti cooler analogy. I'm really big on that one. Why does a Yeti work better? One of the big reasons is it's got this gasket on the sill and you have to crank it down to close it. And when that gasket air seals, boom, that insulation can do its job correctly. It's not fighting this air coming in at a different temperature. And so on my video today, I actually have some B-roll of a Yeti cooler. And I'm saying, now what if your house was a Yeti cooler just built upside down and we flop this Yeti cooler upside down? If you're going to punch some holes in that Yeti cooler, what would you want to fill them with? A double glaze or a triple glaze window? You've got these walls that are really high performance, and at a minimum, even if you have a 2x4 wall, you've got an R15 wall, let's say, but then you've got this window that's R3 if it's double glaze. Is that the best choice for your Yeti cooler, or would a more high performance window at R6 be a better choice? So I think that analogy is a good one. I'm gonna run with that one for a while, but let's snap our fingers and make that go away today, Sean. How about that?
I'd like that for sure. Yeah, enough people wondering if they're going to suffocate in their airtight house. It's not how these things work. The last question that I always ask is a personal interest question. I love books and collect them. You've talked about one already, but if you were to recommend a book to somebody listening, personal or professional, which one would it be?
Man, let me grab one from my nightstand that I'm reading right now that I've loved. It's a sleep book. Why We Sleep, P. Walker, PhD. Have you read it already, Sean?
I have not. No, I just picked it up. It's sitting on my pile of to read.
It's a quick read, and I would tell you it's a book that you don't need to read every page. There's a lot of, he gets into the weeds a little bit on kind of the sleep studies and the data. But if you even read like the first two or three chapters and the last, from what I can tell, the last two or three chapters, the gist of the book, and he even says it, I think, in the first chapter, is like, if you could make an advertisement for sleep, it would look like a midnight infomercial that should be banned, because it's making all these crazy claims like you can reduce your chances of getting Alzheimer's, you can have a better sex life, you can have a better skin, you can have, like all this litany of things. The one that really got me, though, was the Alzheimer's and brain health later in life. 8 hours of sleep is a magic bullet that can do so much good for you. And as Americans, we just don't get it. And the other part he talks about is how caffeine really messes with you. And I've been dumb about caffeine over the years and paid the price, where I'm like, oh, I'd love a cup of coffee for dinner. And I'm in my 40s, and he talks about how your body changes over the years to accept the less caffeine. But, caffeine has a half-life of 7 hours. So if you had even like 2 cups of coffee at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, at 9 p.m., you still have 50% of the caffeine that you drank in your body. And that's one of the reasons why if I have caffeine after lunch anytime, I have a hard time falling asleep before midnight. And so just those kinds of things, and also realizing the importance of sleep, has made me think a lot. I even bought I bought a new wristband called a Whoop band. And if you've ever seen these before, it's a Fitbit style band that you wear all the time, night and day, but there's no screen output. It just Bluetooth to your phone. And I like it because it's kind of unobtrusive. I can wear my regular watch, my dumb watch, not my smart watch. But it tracks everything you do, including your exact amount of sleep. And if you might be in bed for 9 hours, but you actually only got 7 hours and 10 minutes of sleep, is the kind of data it shows you. And I've only had it for a week now, but just even just seeing like the week that I've been paying attention, like I do pretty well on the weekends, but during the week, I start ticking down to like 6 hours at night, and it affects me. And here it is Friday, and I'm tired today. I had a workout today, but I didn't feel 100%. And if I look at my sleep level this week, I probably know why, because I'm just not getting enough. So it's a good book, Sean. I bet you get a lot out of it.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading it for sure. All right, Matt. Well, definitely thank you so much for being on the show. For everyone listening, I'm going to go ahead and put links down below to Matt's social media channels and different ways to get a hold of him there, as well as the Build Show Network website. And with that, Matt, enjoy the rest of your day.
Sean, I really appreciate having me on, brother. Take care, man. I'll see you soon.